Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Audible Autism, Interesting Questions and Interesting Facts. I'm your co-host Sarah, and this is another of our sensory episodes, which is a series of segments that you can sit back and just take in. Coming up, we have a short explanation of gender by me, then Odai has put together a selection of easy listening music, and then we have a short story for you, also read by me. It's all very low intensity, but if you are interested, then there is some interesting content here for you as well. Enjoy!
Testing, testing, testing. Can you hear me? This is Audible Autism.
So in our first segment, we come to the question, what is gender? Gender is thought of by many people as being the same thing as your sex, but it isn't. Your sex is determined by the parts of your body that help you to make children, both the parts on the outside and the parts on the inside. For most people, they are either male or female, though there are some people who have parts that are male and female. Gender is much more about how you feel about yourself. Your maleness or your femaleness, your manliness or your womanliness, and what you think about that in your head. How you choose to look, and what you choose to wear, is determined by how you feel, and how you want other people to think of you. Many people think that there are only two genders, being a man and being a woman, and that there are certain things that only men could do, or wear, and certain things that only women can do, or wear. So some people will say, for example, that men wear trousers and women wear dresses. This can be hard if you feel like a man, but also you like wearing dresses, because people think they can tell you what to do. The truth is that everyone feels differently about their bodies and what clothes they like to wear, and whether they feel like a man or a woman. Sometimes people feel they are more like a man than a woman, and sometimes they feel more like a woman than a man, and sometimes they don't feel like any of these things. And so when people try to tell them that they are a man or a woman, that feels weird. Autistic people, like us, are much more likely to ignore what other people tell them to do, and tell them how they should feel, or how they should dress, or what they should do, which means that we're much more likely to wear what we want and do things that make us happy, rather than what they've told us to do. Autistic people are much more likely to feel that being told their gender is a man or a woman because they have a male or a female body doesn't make sense. Some people feel like they are a man or a woman, and they want to have a body that other people will see as the body of a man or a woman, so they have to go and see a doctor and change it. Other people just want to wear whatever they want. I am a woman, and I have a female body, but I like wearing ties. People keep telling me that ties are for men, and that's really silly because ties look really cool, so why shouldn't I wear a tie if I want to? I look great in a tie. Other people like me wearing ties. I like being a woman, but I don't like it when people tell me that because I'm a woman, I should wear this, or I can't do that. I can wear whatever I want, and I can do whatever I feel like doing. So, however you feel about your gender, whether you feel like a man or a woman, or whether being a man or a woman just seems kind of weird to you and you feel like something completely different, that's completely okay. Lots of people are just like you, whatever you are and however you feel, and you aren't weird. Wear whatever you want and be happy.
story we have for you today is by a classic British author, Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie is most famous for the characters of Hercule Poirot and Mrs. Marple, but she also published a series of short stories by a third character, Parker Pyne, which were published in a single short story collection, Parker Pyne Investigates, in 1934. Parker Pyne is also a brilliant detective, but instead of solving murders, Parker Pyne helps his clients to find happiness. Presumably this idea had less mileage in it, as Agatha Christie never wrote about him again after this short story collection was published. Agatha Christie was an author of her time, and so this story has been lightly edited to remove some terms less acceptable to modern ears. This story is called The Case of the Rich Woman. The name of Mrs. Abner Rymer was brought to Mr. Parker Pyne. He knew the name, and he raised his eyebrows. Presently, his client was shown into the room. Mrs. Rymer was a tall woman, big-boned. Her figure was ungainly, and the velvet dress and the heavy fur coat she wore did not disguise the fact. The knuckles of her large hands were pronounced. Her face was big and broad and highly coloured. Her black hair was fashionably dressed, and there were many tips of curled ostrich in her hat. She plumped herself down on the chair with a nod. "Good morning," she said. Her voice had a rough accent. "If you're any good at all, you'll show me how to spend my money." "Most original," murmured Mr. Parker Pyne. "Few ask that in these days." "Do you really find it difficult, Mrs. Rymer?" "Yes, I do," said the lady bluntly. "I've got 3 fur coats, a lot of Paris dresses and such like. I've got a car and a house in Park Lane. I've had a yacht, but I don't like the sea. I've got a lot of those high-class servants that look down their nose at you. I've travelled a bit and seen foreign parts, and I'm blessed if I can think of anything more to buy or do." She looked hopefully at Mr. Pyne. "There are hospitals," he said. "What? Give it away, you mean? No, that I won't do. That money was worked for, let me tell you. Worked for hard. If you think I'm going to hand it out like so much dirt, well, you're mistaken. I want to spend it. Spend it and get some good out of it. Now, if you've got any ideas that are worthwhile in that line, you can depend upon a good fee." "Your proposition interests me," said Mr. Pyne. "You do not mention a country house." "I forgot it, but I've got one. Bores me to death." "You must tell me more about yourself. Your problem is not easy to solve." "I'll tell you, and willing. I'm not ashamed of what I've come from. Worked in a farmhouse, I did, when I was a girl. Hard work it was, too. Then I took up with Abner. He was a workman in the mills nearby. He courted me for 8 years, and then we got married."
"And you were happy?" asked Mr. Pyne.
"I was. He was a good man to me, Abner. We had a hard struggle of it, though. He was out of a job twice, and children coming along. 4 we had, 3 boys and a girl. And none of them lived to grow up. I dare say it would have been different if they had."
Her face softened, looked suddenly younger.
"His chest was weak, Abner's was. They wouldn't take him for the war. He did well at home. He was made foreman. He was a clever fellow, Abner. He worked out a process. They treated him fair, I will say. Gave him a good sum for it. He used that money for another idea of his. That brought in money hand over fist. He was a master now, employing his own workmen. He brought 2 concerns that were bankrupt and made them pay. The rest was easy. Money came in hand over fist. It's still coming in. Mind you, it was rare fun at first. Having a house and a tip-top bathroom and servants of one's own, no more cooking and scrubbing and washing to do, just sit back on your silk curtains in the drawing room and ring the bell for tea, like any countess might. Grand fun it was, and we enjoyed it. And then we came up to London. I went to swell dressmakers for my clothes, we went to Paris and the Riviera. Rare fun it was."
"And then?" said Mr. Parker Pyne.
"We got used to it, I suppose," said Mrs. Rymer. "After a bit it didn't seem so much fun. Why, there were days when we didn't even fancy our meals properly. Us, with any dish we fancied to choose from. As for baths, well, in the end 1 bath a day is enough for anyone. And Abner's health began to worry him. Paid money to good doctors, we did, but they couldn't do anything. They tried this, they tried that, but no use. He died." She paused. "He was a young man, only 43.
Mr. Pyne nodded sympathetically.
"That was 5 years ago. Money's still rolling in. It seems wasteful not to be able to do anything with it. But as I tell you, I can't think of anything else to buy that I haven't got already."
"In other words," said Mr. Pyne, "your life is dull. You are not enjoying it. I'm sick of it, said Mrs. Rymer gloomily. I've no friends. The new lot only want subscriptions, and they laugh at me behind my back. The old lot won't have anything to do with me. My rolling up in a car makes them shy. Can you do anything or suggest anything?
It is possible that I can, said Mr. Pine slowly. It will be difficult, but I believe there is a chance of success. I think it's possible I can give you back what you have lost. Your interest in life.
How? Demanded Mrs. Rymer curtly.
That, said Mr. Parker Pine, is my professional secret. I never disclose my methods beforehand. The question is, will you take a chance? I do not guarantee success, but I do think there is a reasonable possibility of it.
And how much will it cost?
I shall have to adopt unusual methods, and therefore it will be expensive. My charge will be £1,000, payable in advance.
You can open your mouth all right, can't you? Said Mrs. Rymer appreciatively. Well, I'll risk it. I'm used to paying top price. Only when I pay for a thing, I take good care that I get it.
You shall get it, said Mr. Parker Pine. Never fear.
I'll send you the cheque this evening, said Mrs. Rymer, rising. I'm sure I don't know why I should trust you. Fools and their money are soon parted, they say. I dare say I'm a fool. You've got nerve to advertise in all the papers that you can make people happy.
Those advertisements cost me money, said Mr. Pine. If I could not make good on my words, that money would be wasted. I know what causes unhappiness, and consequently I have a clear idea of how to produce an opposite condition.
Mrs. Rymer shook her head doubtfully and departed, leaving a cloud of expensive mixed essences behind her. The handsome Claude Luttrell strolled into the office.
Something in my line?
Mr. Pine shook his head.
Nothing so simple, he said. No, this is a difficult case. We must, I fear, take a few risks. We must attempt the unusual.
Mrs. Oliver?
Mr. Pine smiled at the mention of the world-famous novelist.
Mrs. Oliver, he said, is really the most conventional of all of us. I have in mind a bold and audacious coup. By the way, you might ring up Dr. Antrobus.
Antrobus?
Yes, his services will be needed.
A week later, Mrs. Rymer once more entered Mr. Parker Pine's office. He rose to receive her.
This delay, I assure you, has been necessary, he said. Many things had to be arranged, and I had to secure the services of an unusual man who had to come half across Europe.
Oh, she said it suspiciously. It was constantly present in her mind that she had paid out a cheque for £1,000, and that cheque had been cashed.
Mr. Parker Pine touched a buzzer. A young girl, dark-haired but dressed in a white nurse's kit, answered it.
Is everything ready, Nurse Sarah?
Yes, Dr. Constantine is waiting.
What are you going to do? Said Mrs. Rymer, with a touch of uneasiness.
Introduce you to some magic, dear lady, said Mr. Parker Pine.
Mrs. Rymer followed the nurse up to the next floor. Here she was ushered into a room that bore no relation to the rest of the house. Embroideries covered the walls. There were divans with soft cushions and beautiful rugs on the floor. A man was bending over a coffee pot. He straightened as they entered.
Dr. Constantine, said the nurse.
The doctor was dressed in a regular lounge suit, but his eyes were dark and oblique, with a peculiarly piercing power in their glance.
So this is my patient, he said in a low, vibrant voice.
I'm not a patient, said Mrs. Rymer.
Your body is not sick, said the doctor, but your soul is weary. We know how to cure that disease. Sit down and drink a cup of coffee.
Mrs. Rymer sat down and accepted the tiny cup of the fragrant brew. As she sipped it, the doctor talked. Here in England, they teach only the body. A mistake. The body is only the instrument. A tune is played upon it. It may be a sad, weary tune. It may be a gay tune, full of delight. That last is what we shall give you. You have money. You shall spend it and enjoy. Life shall be worth living again. It will be easy. Easy. So easy. Easy. A feeling of languor crept over Mrs. Rymer. The figures of the doctor and the nurse grew hazy. She felt blissfully happy and very sleepy. The doctor's figure grew bigger. The whole world was growing bigger. The doctor was looking into her eyes.
Sleep, he was saying. Sleep. Your eyelids are closing. Soon you will sleep. You will sleep. You will sleep. Mrs. Rymer's eyelids closed. She floated with a wonderful, great, big world. When her eyes opened, it seemed to her that a long time had passed. She remembered several things vaguely. Strange, impossible dreams. Then a feeling of waking. Then further dreams. She remembered something about a car and the dark-haired, beautiful girl in nurse's uniform bending over her. Anyway, she was properly awake now, and in her own bed. At least, was it her own bed? It felt different. It lacked the delicious softness of her own bed. It was vaguely reminiscent of days almost forgotten. She moved, and it creaked. Mrs. Rymer's bed in Park Lane never creaked. She looked round. Decidedly, this was not Park Lane. Was it a hospital? No, she decided, not a hospital. Nor was it a hotel. It was a bare room, the walls an uncertain shade of lilac. There was a deal washstand with a jug and a basin upon it. There was a deal chest of drawers and a tin trunk. There were unfamiliar clothes hanging on pegs. There was the bed covered with a much-needed quilt, and there was herself in it. There was the bed covered with a much-mended quilt, and there was herself in it. "Where am I?" said Mrs. Rymer. The door opened and a plump little woman bustled in. She had red cheeks and a good-humoured air. Her sleeves were rolled up and she wore an apron. "Eh!" she exclaimed. "She's awake! Come in, doctor!" Mrs. Rymer opened her mouth to say several things. But they remained unsaid, for the man who had followed the plump woman into the room was not in the least like the elegant Dr. Constantine. He was a bent old man who peered through thick glasses. "That's better," he said, advancing to the bed and taking up Mrs. Rymer's wrist. "You'll soon be better now, my dear." "What's the matter with me?" demanded Mrs. Rymer. "You've had a kind of seizure," said the doctor. "You've been unconscious for a day or two. Nothing to worry about." "Gave us a fright, you did, Hannah," said the plump woman. "You've been raving too, saying the oddest things." "Yes, yes, Mrs. Gardner," said the doctor oppressively, "but we mustn't excite the patient. You'll soon be up and about again, my dear." "But don't you worry about the work, Hannah," said Mrs. Gardner. "Mrs. Roberts has been in to give me a hand, and we've got on fine. Just lie still and get well, my dear." "Why do you call me Hannah?" said Mrs. Rymer. "Oh, it's your name," said Mrs. Gardner, bewildered. "No, it isn't. My name's Amelia. Amelia Rymer. Mrs. Abner Rymer." The doctor and Mrs. Gardner exchanged glances. "Well, just you lie still," said Mrs. Gardner. "Yes, yes. No worry," said the doctor. They withdrew. Mrs. Rymer lay puzzling. Why did they call her Hannah? And why had they exchanged that glance of amused incredulity when she had given them her name? Where was she? And what had happened? She slipped out of bed. She felt a little uncertain on her legs, but she walked slowly to the small dormer window and looked out on a farmyard. Completely mystified, she went back to bed. What was she doing in a farmhouse that she'd never seen before? Mrs. Gardner re-entered the room with a bowl of soup on a tray. Mrs. Rymer began her questions. "What am I doing in this house?" she demanded. "Who brought me here?" "Nobody brought you, my dear. It's your home. Leastways, you've lived here for the last 5 years, and me not suspecting once that you were liable to fits." "Lived here 5 years?" "That's right." "Why, Hannah, you don't still mean that you don't remember." "I've never lived here. I've never seen you before." "You see, you've had this illness and you've forgotten. I've never lived here." "But you have, my dear." Suddenly, Mrs. Gardner darted across a chest of drawers and brought to Mrs. Rymer a faded photograph in a frame. It represented a group of four persons. A bearded man, a plump woman, Mrs. Gardner, a tall, lank maid with a pleasantly sheepish grin, and somebody in a prim dress and apron. Herself. Stupefied, Mrs. Rymer gazed at the photograph. Mrs. Gardner put the soup down beside her and quietly left the room. Mrs. Rymer sipped the soup mechanically. It was good soup, strong and hot. All the time her brain was in a whirl. Who was mad? Mrs. Gardner or herself? One of them must be. But there was the doctor too. "I'm Amelia Rymer," she said firmly to herself. "I know I'm Amelia Rymer, and no one's going to tell me different." She finished the soup. She put the bowl back on the tray. A folded newspaper caught her eye, and she picked it up and looked at the date on it, October 19th. What day had she gone to Mr. Parker Pine's office? Either the 15th or the 16th. then she must have been ill for 3 days. "That rascally doctor," said Mrs. Rymer wrathfully. All the same, she was a shade relieved. She had heard of cases where people had forgotten who they were for years at a time. She'd been afraid some such thing had happened to her. She began turning the pages of the paper, scanning the columns idly, when suddenly a paragraph caught her eye. Mrs. Abner Rymer, widow of Abner Rymer, the button-shank king, was removed yesterday to a private mental health hospital. For the past 2 days she has persisted in declaring that she is not herself, but a servant girl named Hannah Morehouse.
"Hannah Morehouse! So that's it," said Mrs. Rymer. "She's me and I'm her. Kind of double, I suppose. Well, we can soon get that put right, if that oily hypocrite of a Parker Pine is up to some game or other."
But at this minute, her eye was caught by the name Constantine staring at her from the printed page. This time it was a headline. "Dr. Constantine's Claim." At a farewell lecture given last night on the eve of his departure for Japan, Dr. Claudius Constantine advanced some startling theories. He declared that it is possible to prove the existence of the soul by transferring one from one body to another. In the course of his experiments, he had, he claimed, successfully effected a double transfer, the soul of a hypnotized body A being transferred to a hypnotized body B, and the soul of B to the body of A. On recovering from the hypnotic sleep, A declared herself to be B, and B thought herself to be A. For the experiment to succeed, it was necessary to find two people with a great bodily resemblance. It was an undoubted fact that two people resembling each other were en rapport. This was very noticeable in the case of twins, but two strangers, varying wildly in social position but with a marked similarity of feature, were found to exhibit the same harmony of structure. Mrs. Rymer cast the paper from her. "The scoundrel! The scoundrel!" She saw the whole thing now. It was a dastardly plot to get hold of her money. This Hannah Morehouse was Mr. Pine's tool, possibly an innocent one. He and that devil Constantine had brought off this fantastic coup, but she'd expose him, she'd show him up, she'd have the law on him, she'd tell everyone. Abruptly, Mrs. Rymer came to stop in the tide of her indignation. She remembered that first paragraph. Hannah Morehouse had not been a docile tool. She had protested, had declared her individuality, and what had happened? "Clapped into an asylum, poor girl," said Mrs. Rymer. A chill ran down her spine. "They got you in there and they never let you out. The more you said you were sane, the less they'd believe you. There you were and there you stayed. No, Mrs. Rymer wasn't going to run the risk of that." The door opened and Mrs. Gardiner came in.
"Ah, you drank your soup, my dear. That's good. You'll soon be better now." "When was I taken ill?" demanded Mrs. Rymer. "Let me see. It was 3 days ago, on Wednesday. That was the 15th. You were took bad about 4 o'clock. "Ah!" The ejaculation was fraught with meaning. It had just been about 4 o'clock when Mrs. Rymer had entered the presence of Dr. Constantine. "You slipped down in your chair," said Mrs. Gardiner. "Oh," he says, "oh, just like that." And then, "I'm falling asleep," he says in a dreamy voice. "I'm falling asleep." "And fall asleep you did, and we put you to bed and sent for the doctor, and here you've been ever since." "I suppose," Mrs. Rymer ventured, "there isn't any way you could know who I am. Apart from my face, I mean." "Well, that's the queer thing to say," said Mrs. Gardiner. "What is there to go by better than a person's face, I'd like to know? There's your birthmark, though, if that satisfies you better." "A birthmark?" said Mrs. Rymer, brightening. She had no such thing. "Strawberry mark just under the right elbow," said Mrs. Gardiner. "Look for yourself, my dear." "This will prove it," said Mrs. Rymer to herself. She knew she had no strawberry mark under the right elbow. She turned back the sleeve of her nightdress. The strawberry mark was there. Mrs. Rymer burst into tears. 4 days later, Mrs. Rymer rose from her bed. She had thought out several plans of action and rejected them. She might show the paragraph in the paper to Mrs. Gardiner and explain. Would they believe her? Mrs. Rymer was sure they would not. She might go to the police. Would they believe her? Again, she thought not. She might go to Mr. Pine's office. That idea undoubtedly pleased her the best. For one thing, she would like to tell that oily scoundrel what she thought of him. She was disbarred from putting this plan into operation by a vital obstacle. She was at present in Cornwall, so she had learned, and she had no money for the journey to London. 2 and 4 pence in a worn purse seemed to represent her financial position. And so, after 4 days, Mrs. Rymer made a sporting decision. For the present, she would accept that role, and later, when she had saved sufficient money, she would go to London and beard the swindler in his den.
Having thus decided, Mrs. Rymer accepted her role with perfect good temper,
even with a kind of sardonic amusement. History was repeating itself indeed. This life here reminded her of her girlhood. How long ago that seemed. The work was a bit hard after her years of soft living, but after the first week she found herself slipping into the ways of the farm. Mrs. Gardner was a good-tempered, kindly woman. Her husband, a big, taciturn man, was kindly also. The lank, shambling man of the photograph had gone, and another farmhand had come in his stead, a good-humoured giant of 45, slow of speech and thought, but with a shy twinkle in his blue eyes. The weeks went by. At last the day came when Rymer had enough money to pay her fare to London. But she did not go. She put it off. Time enough, she thought. She wasn't easy in her mind about asylums yet. That scoundrel Parker Pine was clever. He'd get a doctor to say she was mad and she'd be clapped out of sight with no one knowing anything about it. Besides, said Mrs. Rymer to herself, a bit of change does one good. She rose early and worked hard. Joe Welsh, the new farmhand, was ill that winter, and she and Mrs. Gardner nursed him. The big man was pathetically dependent on them. Springtime, lambing time, there were wild flowers in the hedges, a treacherous softness in the air. Joe Welsh gave Hannah a hand with her work. Hannah did Joe's mending. Sometimes, on Sundays, they went for a walk together. Joe was a widower. His wife had died 4 years before. Since her death he had, he frankly confessed it, taken a drop too much. He didn't go much to the Crown nowadays. He bought himself some new clothes. Mr. and Mrs. Gardner laughed. Hannah made fun of Joe. She teased him about his clumsiness. Joe didn't mind. He looked bashful but happy. After spring came summer. A good summer that year. Everyone worked hard. Harvest was over. The leaves were red and golden on the trees. It was October 8th when Hannah looked up one day from a cabbage she was cutting and saw Mr. Parker Pine leaning over the fence. You, said Hannah, alias Mrs. Rymer. You. It was some time before she got it all out, but when she'd had her say, she was out of breath. Mr. Parker Pine smiled blandly. I quite agree with you, he said. A cheat and a liar, that's what you are, said Mrs. Rymer, repeating herself. You with your Constantines and your hypnotising, and that poor girl Hannah Morehouse shut up in a hospital. No, said Mr. Parker Pine. There you misjudge me. Hannah Morehouse is not in an asylum, because Hannah Morehouse never existed. Indeed, said Mrs. Rymer. And what about that photograph of her that I saw with my own eyes? Faked, said Mr. Parker Pine. Quite a simple thing to manage. And that piece in the paper about her? The whole paper was faked so as to include items in a natural manner which would carry conviction. As it did. That rogue, Dr. Constantine? An assumed name. Assumed by a friend of mine with a talent for acting. Mrs. Rymer snorted. Ho! And I wasn't hypnotised either, I suppose. As a matter of fact, you were not. You drank your coffee, containing a preparation of hemp. After that, other drugs were administered, and you were brought down here by car and allowed to recover consciousness. The Mrs. Gardner has been in on it the whole time, said Mrs. Rymer. Mr. Parker Pine nodded. Bribed by you, I suppose, or filled up with a whole lot of lies. Mrs. Gardner, trust me, said Mr. Pine. I saved her only son from penal servitude. Something in his manner silenced Mrs. Rymer on the tack. What about the birthmark? She demanded. Mr. Pine smiled. It is already fading. In another 6 months it will have disappeared altogether. And what's the meaning of all this tomfoolery? Making a fool of me, sticking me down here as a servant, me with all that good money in the bank? But I suppose I needn't ask. You've been helping yourself to it, my fine fellow. That's the meaning of all this. It is true, said Mr. Parker Pine, that I did obtain from you, while you were under the influence of drugs, a power of attorney, and that during your absence, I have assumed control of your financial affairs. But I can assure you, my dear madam, that apart from that original £1,000, no money of yours has found its way into my pocket. As a matter of fact, by judicious investments, your financial position is actually improved. He beamed at her. Then why? Began Mrs. Rymer. I'm going to ask you a question, Mrs. Rymer, said Mr. Pine. You are an honest woman. You'll answer me honestly, I know. I'm going to ask you if you are happy. Happy? That's a pretty question. Steal a woman's money and ask her if she's happy? I like your impudence. You are still angry, he said, most natural.
But leave my misdeeds out of it for a moment. Mrs. Rymer, when you came to my office a year ago today, you were an unhappy woman. Will you tell me you are unhappy now? If so, I apologize, and you are at liberty to take whatever steps you please against me. Moreover, I will refund you the £1,000 you paid me. Come, Mrs. Rymer, are you unhappy? Mrs. Rymer looked at Mr. Parker Pine, and she dropped her eyes when she spoke at last. No, she said, I'm not unhappy. A tone of wonder crept into her voice. You've got me there, I admit it. I've not been as happy as I am now since Abner died. I'm going to marry a man who works here, Joe Welsh. Our banns are going up next Sunday. That is, they were going up next Sunday. But now, of course, said Mr. Pine, everything is different. Mrs. Rymer's face flamed. She took a step forward. What do you mean, different? Do you think if I had all the money in the world it would make me a lady? I don't want to be a lady, thank you. A helpless, good-for-nothing lot they are. Joe's good enough for me and I'm good enough for him. We suit each other and we're going to be happy. As for you, Mr. Nosey Parker, you take yourself off and don't interfere with what don't concern you. Mr. Parker Pine took a paper from his pocket and handed it to her. The power of attorney, he said. Shall I tear it up? You will assume control of your own fortune now, I take it. A strange expression came over Mrs. Rymer's face. She thrust back the paper. Take it. I've said hard things to you, and some of them you deserved. You're a downy fellow, but all the same I trust you. £700 I'll have in the bank here. That'll buy us a farm we've got our eye on. The rest of it, well, let the hospitals have it. You cannot mean to hand over your entire fortune to hospitals. That's just what I do mean. Joe's a dear good fellow, but he's weak. Give him money and you'd ruin him. I've got him off the drink now, and I'll keep him off it. Thank God I know my own mind. I'm not going to let money come between me and happiness. You are a remarkable person, said Mr. Pine slowly. Only one in a thousand would act as you are doing. And only a one in a thousand's got sense, said Mrs. Rymer. I take my hat off to you, said Mr. Parker Pine, and there was an unusual note in his voice. He raised his hat with solemnity and moved away. And Joe's never to know, mind, Mrs. Rymer called after him. She stood there with the dying sun behind her, a great blue-green cabbage in her hands, her head thrown back and her shoulders squared, a grand figure of a peasant outlined against the setting sun.
If you would like to stay in touch with us, you can check out our website at www.audibleautism.com for links to things discussed in the episode and for our back archive. You can subscribe to us on most podcast distribution platforms, including iTunes. Just search for Audible Autism. This podcast is part of a larger project, the Autistic Empire, which is aiming to create an autistic community centered around our interests as autistic people. You can check us out at www.autisticempire.com. We post all of Audible Autism's episodes to our Autistic Empire channels, so you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and we're even on Pinterest. Just search Autistic Empire to receive news and updates. We also have a forum where enrolled citizens can discuss the latest episodes and other issues of interest to autistic people, so do check that out as well. If you have any questions or would like to get in touch with us to be on a future episode of Audible Autism, you can always email us at team@audibleautism.com. Thank you for listening.